For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first and number one global fintech show. This is JP Nichols sitting in for Brett this week. Penny Crosman from American Bankers here to chat about some of the headlines in fintech this week. Then we have Brian Patrick Iha, who's just written a book that couldn't have better timing, How Money Got Free, all about Bitcoin, along with our friend Dave Birch, who's also just published a book called Before Babylon, Beyond Bitcoin. Then in the second half of the show, we're going to be joined by Aubrey Hawes, Senior Director of Oracle's Financial Services Global Business Unit, and Dan Roselli, founder of Queen City FinTech, to talk about their work to make Charlotte, North Carolina, a FinTech hub. And we'll talk about the upcoming Next Money Southeast Conference, which reminds me, we've got a bushel of conference announcements. As Sam Mall said on last week's show, we seem to have become the Groupon of conferences, but that's okay because these are all good. So first of all, we have the Columbia Summit at Columbia University. It's coming up on June 8th and 9th, and day two is the new Innovators and Investors Day. You can go to DFS Summit to register and use the code BREAKINGBANKS for a 25% discount. Findever is prepping for their London conference June 12th and 13th. Get your tickets now and save hundreds off the list prices. Also use the code BBanksDevR20 to save an additional 20%. Next Money is having their Next Money Southeast Conference coming up in Charlotte, North Carolina, June 21st. I'll be hosting that day, so we'll talk more about that later in the show. Breaking Banks listeners can save 25% there with the code BB25 at se17.nextmoney.org. We're also looking forward to Finovate Fall coming up in New York, September 11th through 17th. Register now. You can get a 20% registration discount using the code BREAKINGBANKS20. And we're also pleased to announce that NTT Data is sponsoring us as podcast partners for Money 2020 in both Europe and in the U.S. Breaking Banks will be in Copenhagen coming up in June, podcasting live from the event, or at least recorded from the event, talking to key speakers and attendees. So Sam Ball will also be there with his FinTech 5 podcast, and I'll be there too, getting ready to launch my own new podcast, The Serial Entrepreneur, where I'll be focusing on the leaders who battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. You'll hear more about that soon, and we'll see you there in Copenhagen in the main hall. And last but not least, American Banker having their Blockchain and Digital Currencies Conference on June 13th. You can use the code BREAKING for now and get off $150 off of the registration. So you can find out about all these conferences on our conference and sponsor page at BreakingBanks.com. They'll all be listed there along with all the discount codes. Plus, you can find all of our back episodes and more information about our guests and our hosts at BreakingBanks.com. So, Penny Crosman, welcome back. What's in the news this week?
Thank you. Well, one thing that that I thought was kind of interesting was Fiserv came out with a survey about saying that small businesses are more willing than ever to switch banks. About 14% of small and medium-sized businesses switched banks last year. 18% considering switching this coming year. The reasons they gave for switching range from getting better prices than others, more than a third said that, referrals from other companies, failure to reserve, their existing bank's failure to reserve problems, quickly poor customer service, et cetera. But they also expressed some dissatisfaction with a number of other things about their bank relationships. They said they gave their banks negative scores in the areas of trust, security, competitive pricing, fraud protection, and reliability. as well as omni-channel consistency, having leading-edge products, being customized, offering financial control, and being anticipatory. So it's kind of, to me, it's kind of a roadmap of things that banks might want to think about as they improve their or work on their small business apps and offerings. And it's also kind of a roadmap for fintechs that want to offer more in this area.
Yeah. So Penny, is any of that surprising to you?
I guess I was a little surprised at how much, to the degree to which small businesses feel that their banks are not meeting their expectations. I mean, you know, a lot of banks don't really emphasize this segment, don't find it as profitable as the other extremes of the market. But I was a little surprised at how much they don't trust the security of their banks kind of surprised me, because banks usually rank pretty high in trust and security,
right?
You know, considered a vault. So I
agree with that, but I think in general it seems fairly predictable pattern for me. It follows so much of what happens with the consumers, right? The PCs and tablets and smartphones all came into the workplace following the consumers. And I think that there's a great opportunity here because of what you said. It's a segment that's difficult to service profitably. And boy, that's certainly a place where you want to apply technology. So what else is in the news?
Well, there was a peer-to-peer lender, Zopa, raised £32 million in the UK. They're part of this whole very healthy fintech industry that's very well supported in the UK. And they really want to become a full-fledged bank. They want to offer deposit accounts, peer-to-peer investment products, personal loans, car finance, credit cards. So I think, and they say they want to launch a next generation bank to offer more choice, which they say is good for consumers and good for the economy. So, you know, it does seem like England is sort of leading a lot of other countries in this generation of challenger banks, and they just seem to be doing very well. However, they do say it could take about 2 years for them to get this banking license. So it's still kind of early days for them.
So maybe we're moving from this unbundling period to a rebundling period.
Yeah, it does. In a way, it does kind of seem. Yeah, they're going to look more like a traditional bank. And
well, did we lose you there, Penny? Well, I think we may have. So why don't we move on then? We've got Brian Patrick Iha is a writer and American banker and also the author of How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance, along with Dave Birch, who I mentioned also has written a book called Before Babylon and Before Bitcoin. So Brian, explain the title of your book.
Thanks for having me, JP. The title of my book really pertains to the idea that Bitcoin and other digital currencies represent the next evolution of money, free from the control of governments and central banks, and even from the physical form we're used to carrying in our wallets. And also in a social sense, there are people, some of the characters in my book, who believe that the free flow of capital is a human right. So in this view, any law that prevents you from using your money however you want, like sending it to a relative in Cuba, let's say, is infringing on your liberty and potentially on your human rights. And then the subtitle about the fight for the future of finance is really multifaceted. So in the early days, it was a lot of idealistic libertarians and crypto anarchists fighting to build a new financial order outside the control of government and the big banks. Basically, a bunch of young people got their hands on a new kind of money, and they proceeded to do what young people always do, which is scare the crap out of adults. And some of them got rich. But then as mainstream investors and more experienced entrepreneurs got involved, a kind of tug of war developed between the old guard, who wanted to keep Bitcoin true to its roots, and then this other group who were interested, as the venture capitalist Marc Andreessen once put it, in fringe technology, but not fringe politics. And then finally, we're kind of in this new phase where there's actually a fight or competition among different cryptocurrencies, some of them potential rivals of Bitcoin or successors to Bitcoin. And every major financial firm at the same time seems to be racing to develop its own version of blockchain technology, which is the technology underlying digital currency. So it's quite a scene, and that's what the narrative of my book is about.
So you've taken a journalistic approach, and you're really telling the story of Bitcoin through the eyes of its pioneers. What caused you to take that approach?
Well, look, early internet pioneers had always envisioned that a payments protocol would be woven into the fabric of the web as a basic element. You had smart guys like Peter Thiel building PayPal, and his original ambition was for it to be an internet currency that would replace the U.S. dollar for online transactions. What stopped him from creating that was the regulations that came down after 9/11. He would have been accused of money laundering and things like that. When I first heard about Bitcoin back in 2011, it struck me as an idea whose time had come, but I didn't yet kind of know anybody that was in the space. So finally, in the summer of 2012, I wrote about Bitcoin for the first time as a staff writer at CNN Money. And I'll never forget, when I pitched this Bitcoin story to my editor, she told me, okay, go ahead and do it, but don't make too much of it. You know, she said, Bitcoin is just this digital curiosity. It's like a plaything for crypto anarchists. And I already kind of suspected she might be wrong, but I really didn't have enough ammunition to argue with that. But I went and did the story, and that was my first time meeting entrepreneurs in the Bitcoin space. I went to the Flatiron District in Manhattan, where this startup was located. And as I talked to these guys, I just really became overwhelmed with the sense that that Bitcoin had real potential. I mean, these guys were young, they were hungry, passionate, and they were kind of from that Mark Zuckerberg school of, wanting to move fast and break stuff. And I was just fascinated by how they were risking everything to build the foundations of a new economy. And so the CEO of that startup, I kind of stayed in touch with, I kept tabs on him, and he became one of the main characters in my book. And it was as I then was an editor at Entrepreneur, and I continued to write about Bitcoin, and I wrote about it for The New Yorker. And as things kept rolling on and I just kind of met more people in the space, it was really through the lives and work of these people that I understood how rich a book-length narrative of Bitcoin could be.
Well, that's great. Well, let's bring Dave Birch into the conversation too. Sure. Dave, you've been spending a lot of time in this space yourself, and you've got a new book out. So I'll start with the same question. Explain the title of your book and tell us a little bit about what it's about and the approach that you took.
Before Babylon, the clay tablets and all that kind of thing. And that money's going to be...
Dave, we've got you in a bad spot of London there. I'm glad that you made time to join us, but we seem to have caught you at a really bad time. So let me give you one more shot here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, go ahead. That sounded a little better.
I'll tell you what, can you hear me better now?
I think so. Why don't you give it another shot of talking about your book title and your approach? I think we're all
the line's
for two,
breaking
so.
Up. I'll tell you what.
That's a shame.
Yeah. So, Dave, we'll definitely get you back on to talk about that. I know that Brett wrote the foreword of the book, and I've seen pieces of it already. So I'm definitely anxious to talk about it. But maybe I'll just stick with Brian here to talk a little bit more about this. And
well, I hope I can fill the shoes of two men.
Well, nobody can fill Dave's shoes. We all know that. But I'm curious how, as you've tracked this through a period of time, we're in a period now where
Bitcoin's become hotter than ever, and the price is spiking. What do you think of that? How does that fit into your narrative? Does it fit into what you saw coming, or was it surprising for you?
Oh, this recent explosion you're talking about in the price of Bitcoin?
Yes.
Well, I think the easy answer is to make myself Nostradamus and say I definitely saw it coming. I think the more humble answer is to say that some of the main characters in my book definitely saw it coming. One of the characters who I find really fascinating and really brilliant is a guy named Barry Silbert, who used to be an investment banker, and then he left that job years ago to start his own brokerage firm. And during the financial crisis, when all these different classes of assets were, the markets for them were freezing up and investors were left kind of up a creek, he single-handedly made a secondary market in all of these different assets to kind of help them out. And it, of course, it was very profitable for his business. And then he became a successful entrepreneur in that way, and then encountered Bitcoin and decided this was the next asset that his brokerage firm was going to get into. And so they created the world's first investment fund for Bitcoin. And he himself was, you know, he invested $200,000 into it when it was between, you know, $5 and $10, which is incredible. You know, when you think about the price today of being over $2,000 for weeks now. But he always, even in the doldrums of 2015 and so on, when the price of Bitcoin kind of, after some scandals, it sort of slipped back down into the low hundreds. He was always very sure that another huge price rise was coming, or a new bubble, if you want to call it that. And he also felt not only that it was coming, but that it was necessary in order for Bitcoin to really achieve its full potential. Because if its ambition is to be a digital gold or a new global currency, you know, you really can't have a market cap of $5 billion. Much as that might seem huge to the average person, you know, you need $50 billion or $100 billion or $500 billion as a market cap to really serve a global user base. So I think I saw the writing on the wall to some extent, but certainly the characters in the book are more interesting than me and probably more prescient than me in that regard.
So where do you see it going from here?
Oh, boy. Well, it reached, you know, almost $2,800 the other week, and it looked like it was heading for $3,000, and then for some mysterious reason, it deflated a bit. And I guess, you know, it had had such a huge sustained rise from about $1,200 or $1,400 all the way up to almost $2,800. So I guess it was time for a retrenchment. But I really do think it will hit 3,000. But as for when that will happen, I'm not sure. What I think is more important than the market price, though, is that we're going to start to see Bitcoin and maybe other cryptocurrencies, who knows, but we're going to start to see Bitcoin fulfill some of the predictions that early adopters first made for digital currency years ago. You know, I think a great example would be remittances. You know, remittances, when immigrants send money back home to their families, that's a $600 billion market. That's how much money, you know, really flows every year from immigrants back to these other countries. And in my book, one character predicts that Bitcoin is going to do to Western Union and MoneyGram what Netflix did to Blockbuster, he says. Well, that hasn't happened just yet, you know, and some people have been a little surprised it hasn't happened quite yet. But it looks like that might be on the horizon. There's a venture-backed company called Abra that just launched a couple of months ago, and they're using Bitcoin today to provide cheaper remittances to more than 100 countries. So Bitcoin has a chance to grab a piece of that market while putting billions of dollars back into people's pockets. I think that's definitely you know, a really amazing thing.
It is. Brian, when you say characters, I mean, these are real-life people. Do they use their own names, or have you anonymized them in your book?
Oh, no. No one is, pretty much no one is an anonymous source, except I think there's a couple instances with a startup called BitInstant, which was based here in New York. It was the first one to raise significant venture capital. Back in 2012, it raised $1.5 million. And if that sounds small for a capital raise, you know, you have to understand the total market cap of Bitcoin back then was only about $100 million. But at any rate, there are a couple of former employees of that company who I let be, you know, semi-anonymous in the comments they made about the company. But otherwise, yeah, there's a complete nonfiction. It's a deep character-driven narrative, but it's all nonfiction.
Who predicted that Bitcoin would be the new Western Union?
Oh, it's a guy named, he's not a huge character in the book, but a guy named Michael Sonnenschein, who was actually one of Barry Silbert's employees at his company.
So were there any favorite characters that stood out to you in all the interviews that you did in writing the book?
Sure. Well, there was, you know, all of them are so interesting. And one of the things I was at pains to do in the book was to kind of exemplify the different facets of Bitcoin as it developed. And I needed at least one main character for kind of each of the different aspects of it. So like Barry Silbert comes in later in the book, and he represents the moment when Bitcoin really crossed over from the early kind of crypto anarchists and libertarians to, you know, the more mainstream Wall Street and finance guys. But I would say maybe one of my favorite characters to follow is a guy named Charlie Schrem. His story resonates with me because he was just a young middle-class guy living with his parents in Brooklyn before he discovered Bitcoin. And he co-founded that startup BitInstant I mentioned that raised, you know, was the first to raise significant venture capital in the industry. And of all the major players in those days, you know, he was perhaps the one most gratified, I found, by the attention and most eager for the, you know, the publicity and the fame and the respect that came from his leadership role in the community. He ended up co-founding the Bitcoin Foundation, which was the first kind of nonprofit advocacy group in the industry. Mm-hmm. And but he also ended up suffering more than most. He threw some things that he did at his company. He ended up having to spend more than a year in federal prison as a result. So I think that now he's out and he's actually trying to work on a comeback. So I think there's a pathos there that really gets me. It's just because it's kind of my background too, just that story of a middle-class kid made good and then his fall from grace and now his attempt at a comeback. I think that's compelling.
Did you look at some of the other cryptocurrencies in depth, or did you pretty much stay focused on Bitcoin?
Well, the book, you know, I started writing it. I got the book deal actually originally in December 2013. I started really, you know, writing it in 2014. So this kind of new explosion that we're seeing of some of these really legitimate alternative cryptocurrencies, it hadn't yet come into full flower during the time I was writing the book. But I do delve into what they called altcoins. Those emerged really starting in 2014. But early on, many of them were just kind of clones of Bitcoin. Since Bitcoin runs on open source software, anybody was able to kind of take that code and then make some tweaks to the parameters and release their own digital currency. And so from, you know, no cryptocurrencies existing prior to January 2009, we now have hundreds. Some of them actually have technological innovations that make them, I think, quite valuable alongside Bitcoin. But others, they really don't have value beyond the use cases that Bitcoin itself has. And of course, Bitcoin has that great first mover advantage and unparalleled name recognition.
Sorry, can I jump in? You know, one of the use cases we've been seeing for Bitcoin is ransomware, you know, where hackers want to lock up a company's computers. You know, we've seen it a lot in healthcare. And then they demand a ransom in Bitcoin. And they believe that the money, the movement of the money can't be traced. Now, there's a whole cottage industry of companies that do just that.
Right.
And you know, some people say this is going to, this kind of activity is going to make regulators zero in and try to control this this whole area. What do you think? What do you think might happen with that?
With the regulation, well, you know, the ransomware is interesting, and it's something I actually was writing a big feature about a while ago for Rolling Stone, and then that kind of fell apart for various reasons. But it's something I was looking into even over a year ago before that huge WannaCry outbreak that got everybody talking about it. And in a way, I see it as sort of the flip side to the remittances that I was talking about, that if you have this borderless universal currency that can be sent peer-to-peer without involving any third parties, then, or at least certainly not any traditional third parties, well, then you can, you know, have migrants from sub-Saharan Africa send money back to their families. On the other hand, you can have cyber criminals in Russia kind of reach out and touch people in a bad way on the other side of the world. So, you know, that's one thing. I think it's, in a sense, you have the upsides and the downsides of something so new and radical like Bitcoin. As for the regulators, to be honest, I think if they were going to ban Bitcoin, they would have already done it. You know, not to say you could ever really stop anyone from using it because of the nature of Bitcoin, but you could certainly make it difficult for startups that want to work with it and things like that. But the Cambridge University put out a report recently that said the number of cryptocurrency users worldwide now rivals the population of small countries. So that starts to reach a level that you can't just kind of bring the ban hammer down on. And then also we live in a globalized world where in some sense every country is competing with every other. And if the US were to, you know, really harshly come down on this technology, that innovation would flow to places like Singapore. It would flow to places like Japan, which Japan just recently came out and said, yes, these digital currencies are a valid form of money. And they were the first country in the world to really declare that. And they're the world's third largest economy. So I think regulators really have to balance their desire to crack down on criminal activity against the need to, you know, keep the talent and innovation happening on our shores.
So, Brian, before we go to break, maybe one last question for you, and then you can tell us again the name of the book and where we can find it. But the question is, as you look forward, what do you think has the most bright future, or the brightest future? Mm-hmm. Is it Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, or is it the underlying blockchain and distributed ledger technology that's being used in other use cases beyond cryptocurrencies?
Mm. Sure. Well, yeah, the blockchain technology, you know, is going to have a lot of applications, I think, for enterprise clients, and it's not always going to be tied to cryptocurrency. So I definitely think that's something that's going to happen. You know, all the major global banks and so on have set up their own working groups and blockchain labs to study it. So far, most of them have only come out with kind of pilots and proofs of concept, but many of them have said this is the year that the rubber needs to meet the road and they need to come out with production-ready solutions. So we'll see if they can do that. But I think unquestionably one of the most exciting stories in finance and tech right now is this explosion of alternative cryptocurrencies and blockchain tokens. Blockchain tokens don't have a blockchain of their own, but they sit atop an existing the blockchain of an existing cryptocurrency, and altogether they're a new class of digital assets that has a market value of more than $80 billion, which is incredible. And basically, these teams of software developers have been launching dozens of these new digital tokens and raising more than $400 million, maybe close to $500 million for them just in the past 18 months. And the interesting thing is they tend to be purpose-built for specific decentralized applications. So like there's one called Golem, which powers a peer-to-peer marketplace for computation. And there's one called Augur, which is for a crowdsourced prediction market, and so on. And some tech investors are calling these token-powered applications the second business model of the internet, because it's a model in which, unlike with Facebook and other platforms today, there's no longer a clear division between users and owners. By holding these liquid digital assets, everyone, even average consumers, can kind of own a piece of the future. And these assets trade on 24-hour online exchanges all over the world. So that's what I would say is really exciting right now.
All right. The very last question, very quickly, before we go to break. What's your prediction for the price of Bitcoin by the end of the year?
Sure. Well, before I answer that, let me just say my book, How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance, is available right now in the US and the UK. You can get it in bookstores around the country, and you can get it on Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk. And I've also signed a deal with a Chinese publisher, so there is going to be a Chinese edition of the book, but I'm not sure exactly when that'll be coming out, so look for that. And my prediction for the price, I kind of touched on that earlier. Can't say for sure. Don't take me as your investment advisor, but I do think the price is going to hit $3,000, but whether that happens in 6 days or 6 months, it's hard to say.
All right, fair enough. Yep. So thanks again for being here, Brian Patrick Iha, with How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks.
Thanks so much.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is JP Nichols. I'm here with Dan Roselli from Queen City FinTech and Aubrey Haas from Oracle, both from the Queen City, Charlotte, North Carolina, although Aubrey's actually joining us from Mumbai very late in his evening, so thanks for that. But Dan, let me go to you first, and before we get to Packard Place and Queen City FinTech, you seem to be addicted to starting up companies. You're the CEO of Customer Stream, co-founder of Packard Place, and co-founder of RevTech Labs, co-founder of Queen City FinTech. What is it about you that seems to want to start a new company, and how do those things all fit together?
Yeah, thanks, JP, for letting me be on. I think I like doing crazy things, right? I like big challenges, to be quite honest with you. I like finding opportunities that people look at and other people either can't see the opportunity in or think it's going to be too much effort, too much lifting to go do. Those are the things that really motivate me and make things happen. I guess the connective tissue for all that stuff is that it really does help move our community forward, and they're all for-profit businesses. I think it's interesting. I think we've scripted two generations of entrepreneurs around the world in this idea that you can make money or, and we put a big fat or there, you can go do good. And I'm a big believer in this social entrepreneurship, conscious capitalism movement that we can make money in our companies and have huge positive social impact at the same time. That's probably a good common thread for the things that have turned me on in my life.
Well, that's great. So just to help us set the stage here, describe at least a little bit about Packard Place, your physical space, co-working space that you operate there in Charlotte, and the Queen City FinTech program that operates out of Packard Place. Tell us about what those are all about.
Yeah, so Packard Place is about 6.5 years old. We did this crazy thing in the middle of the Great Recession and bought a downtown office building in Charlotte that was almost completely empty and was going to be torn down, with the idea of turning it into an entrepreneurship hub for the city. And it's turned out phenomenally well. 140, 150 high-growth companies, 300 to 400 entrepreneurial events a year. It's one of the largest tech and innovation centers anywhere in the United States. From that platform, we talked about how do we do young company acceleration, and doing some strategic work and looking at Charlotte and saying, where could Charlotte go and compete and win nationally and internationally? FinTech made a ton of sense. Everyone probably knows Bank of America is headquartered here, but there's also just a ton of large financial services companies with headquarters or tech operations here, literally tens and thousands of financial service subject matter experts, potential entrepreneurs themselves or mentors. And so all the right critical mass and DNA was sitting here in Charlotte. And we brought it together under an accelerator program called the Queen City FinTech Accelerator. So we do what a lot of accelerators do around the world, which is bring companies in a specific niche for a period of time to accelerate their business models, connect them with mentors, connect them to capital. The class we have right now in Charlotte, sitting downstairs from where I'm talking to you, 12 companies from all around the world. Had 150 companies apply from 30 countries, half the states. The 12 founders are from Tel Aviv to Brazil, two from Silicon Valley, three from the New York area, a couple from the Carolinas, Maryland, Colorado, Utah, really from all over the world. And they've come here because we've created a really accessible fintech subject matter expertise network in the Carolinas. And the last thing I'll say, I joke about this, when recruiting entrepreneurs from London or New York or even Silicon Valley, you know, why come to Charlotte? And the answer is, it doesn't matter how big New York or London's fintech ecosystem is if you don't have access to it. And what we've done here is we've really built a coordinated access to all the resources that Charlotte and the Carolinas have, and it's a really compelling value proposition for these young fintech startups.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so from the serial entrepreneur Dan Roselli to the serial entrepreneur Aubrey Haas. Aubrey, you started at IBM as a software developer, project manager. You came to Oracle through your time at Siebel, and now you're the senior director of product marketing for Oracle. How's your role as an entrepreneur rising inside these larger tech companies influenced the way that you think about startups and about fintech?
Yeah, so there's one interesting piece that you left out in my bio. So between IBM and Siebel, I did go to work for a startup that was VC-backed out of Dublin, Ireland, called Eon Tech, and joined them. We were probably about 60, 70 people, went as high as about 300 and then kind of right-sized to 120 to get gobbled up by Siebel. So part of that was kind of going into Siebel and going into Oracle was really that passion that exists with those entrepreneurs around pursuing an idea, wanting to really execute on that idea and kind of change the world. I mean, I think if the culture here at Oracle is really, you know, starts back from our founder, Larry, around that idea about how do you go back and really drastically change things, think about things differently. And so what's been really exciting to see kind of what's been happening over the last several years around fintechs and startups and really how can Oracle kind of go back and help participate in that, help drive some of the insight you've gained either through software development, through technology, through tools, through leadership to actually go back and help these guys actually execute, whether that's leveraging our know-how or leveraging our software. So it's been really exciting.
So in your role, do you spend more time with the people inside financial institutions or more time with the startups like the kind that are hanging out with Dan at his place?
So I would say I probably spend more time with the banks. I'd say two-thirds of my time with the banks, a third of my time with the startups. But I think what becomes quite interesting is, since I've gotten connected with Dan, is the ability to kind of bridge those gaps, because I think there is a lot of places that aren't doing really what Dan's trying to do in Charlotte, which is actually try to build this larger ecosystem with a lot of the financial services, larger companies here, and actually connecting them with those startups. And so much insights can be gained around how do you apply, what should you do, what are the core things to go back and think about that really helps, I think, other banks that aren't in Charlotte, you know, kind of around the globe, really think about how can they start to work with fintechs and collaborate with fintechs. And I think the good thing is, at least a lot of these banks, I think it's kind of progressed in thinking that it's no longer fintechs in my competition. Really, fintechs can really be kind of my partner and help me kind of modernize.
Right. So you've seen that conversation evolve over the years you've been involved.
Oh, yeah. I think it's absolutely kind of changed. In the early days, it was all about, oh, my gosh, what are these guys who are out here to eat my lunch? And I think, you know, that's really changed. It first kind of changed on the different parts of kind of the fintech, because, right, there's so many different areas that they focus in. And I think that's really kind of completely changed now. And I think also, you know, a lot of these startups and fintechs have really, I think, changed their thinking that says, hey, it's too much work to maybe take on the whole model. There's really a better way to actually go help the whole model evolve and the ability to go back and work together. So I think it's been a kind of a nice progression to see how that can actually change, because I think at the end, you know, really all the different consumers, you know, folks like you and I can really kind of benefit from a much better and stronger ecosystem.
And JP, we've seen that too. This is Dan. Even in the accelerator, we've seen that exact same phenomenon that Aubrey's talking about, that it's interesting to see. Originally, when we approached big companies about being involved in the accelerator, there was resistance. And they realized that being close to that disruption is in their enlightened self-interest to do, and why they've stayed engaged in what we've been doing. So I can validate those comments from the other side of the table.
Have either of you seen any new technologies from a startup or an incumbent that really knocked your socks off recently, or that you think might be the next big thing or have tremendous potential?
Well, we had one that graduated from last year's class, which I found fascinating, a company called Trust Stamp that's basically trying to create a digital consumer FICO score for trust. Think of the digital breadcrumbs that consumers leave around and the amount of P2P interactions happening online now, and that idea to be able to create for a new digital economy a way of rating what's going on. And they've just had tremendous traction post the program. And I thought that kind of twist on an old concept taken in the digital age was fascinating.
That does sound interesting.
Well, that's great. So we have Next Money Southeast coming up. Last year called Next Money Charlotte, and you're really kind of expanding your approach this year. Tell us about what you have coming up, who's going to be there, and what kind of topics you're going to be covering.
Sure. Well, I think the event we had last year was so successful. Thanks. We're building on that this year to expand it regionally. We think, and we see this in the Southeast United States, just a ton of collaboration. Atlanta is a major payments hub. There's some interesting fintech startups across the state of North Carolina. And we think by creating some synergies in that space, we realize we're competing against Singapore and London and New York. And as a region, if you aggregate the number of startups, the venture capital, the expertise, can compete as a region against any other region in the world. And that's a compelling reason why to get everyone together. And Aubrey, sorry for interrupting, but love to hear your thoughts as well.
Yeah, no, I think what we realized, what we created last year in this event, where we kind of tied this next money event, thought leadership, actually how do we kind of drive this collaboration between fintechs, existing financial institutions, entrepreneurship, with the Queen City Fintech Demo Day kind of at the end of it. This is kind of our, kind of like the stamp on the finale, really works. And I think what we really wanted to do is expand this beyond just Charlotte, because I think in the Southeast we've got several different banking hubs, whether it gets back into Atlanta and fintech hubs, you know, Birmingham, Alabama, up through Raleigh and up into Richmond and Virginia. So the thought was, is let's really go back and expand this out, because maybe some of those other markets aren't quite as big as Charlotte, but certainly can benefit from this larger thought around how do we actually bring these different communities together to really help go drive this change and dialogue.
Great. Well, last year, go ahead.
I was going to think the point you were going to make about the speakers and who we have this year, which is where I was going to go. It's interesting in Charlotte, it's easier to be able to hold an event like that because we have world-class thought leaders in fintech and entrepreneurship coming to Charlotte anyways. And that's what we did in our event last year. You know, we had Brad Feld, the founder of Techstars, a foundry group here. Matt Harris from Bain Capital, Kathy Besant. This year, one of our headline speakers is Nigel Morris, the founder of Cap One and QED Investors. And part of the reason we have that intellectual flow already coming through Charlotte is they happen to be here for board meetings of companies that are already invested and bought into in terms of fintech startups here in Charlotte. So you're starting to see that synergistic momentum in the wheel pick up, and that allows us to do an event like that. I think this year's event is going to be another breakout success.
Well, yeah, last year I heard a lot of great things on social media about Brad Feld's session. What did he talk about, and why were people so enthralled with that?
Well, you got to understand, first of all, that he's up there, I think, in flip-flops and a Hawaiian shirt and drinking a draft beer with me as we sat.
As expected,
Yes, as expected. And we had a really interesting kind of casual conversation. I've had the opportunity to interact with Brad a couple times and get to know him. And we didn't ask kind of the typical questions, right, that everyone's heard 1,000 times. Particularly, we talked about, you know, what happens, how do you handle some of the naysayers, right? We talk about all this, and I'm sure there's people listening in that we talk about fintech in Charlotte, and they kind of roll their eyes or chuckle or whatever it may be. And Brad took a really compelling stab at why these kind of rise of the rest cities, which is a term, if you're in the entrepreneurship world, you may have heard about these non kind of tier one New York, San Francisco markets rising up and competing on an international level. And when someone like that says it, who's not from Charlotte, but says it with passion and conviction and explains why that's possible, you can see people listening at a different level of what might be, and I think what is starting to happen and become a reality.
Well, and he's proved the same thing in Boulder, Colorado, right?
It's actually called the Boulder Thesis, right? His 5-point kind of steps on that. And it's not rocket science. It's, you know, step by step, creating a long-term vision, getting the right people at the table. And that's how you change big things. You change it one step at a time.
So Aubrey, from your perspective, and Dan, yours too, but what needs to come next for Charlotte? I mean, what is missing? Do you have enough VCs? Is it university research? What are the pieces of the puzzle that you need? I know, Dan, you've talked about Seattle and some of the communities that you've looked at before. Where does Charlotte need to go from here to really be a fintech hub?
I guess my opening thesis, and Dan would probably validate this, I think it is a fintech hub. I don't think it's like we need to do anything to become one. I think to help drive home even more and to keep these companies that want to actually come back and incubate here is really to go back and do two things. One is to drive more community involvement around that.
to even roll it out on a grander scale. And then the other challenge is looking at is the growth. It's the growth capital that a lot of these startups that come to Charlotte, which is that probably hasn't been the history for Charlotte to be really deep and strong in that area, is to really have that so these companies can actually grow. Because I can't tell you how many folks from the Northeast or California has come to Charlotte and just kind of really embrace the community, love the community. It's just really what they need is this capital creation to help actually help these companies actually grow to get scale.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of what Aubrey just said there. And I think, you know, being a kind of an ex-marketing guy by background, one of my favorite expressions about marketing and branding is that perception always lags reality. And I think I agree with Aubrey's comment that Charlotte already is a massive financial services center and a fintech hub. I just don't think that that reality has gotten woven into everyone's perception around the world of it yet. So I think it's still one of those better kept secrets that we're trying to not make a better kept secret. There's certainly tons of venture capital. Matter of fact, I walked away from the session with Class 6 where there's four venture capitalists right now talking to the class about what venture capital looks for and how to move that forward. And I think all the right elements are here. I think it's interesting that you know, growing ecosystems is like farming, and it takes some time for the seeds that you planted and the fertilization to happen, and it's all there. It's just becoming ripe. And I think there will be an opportunity for partners around the country, around the world, to take advantage of the fact that valuations haven't inflated yet for companies in Charlotte. That a $5 million Series A round in Charlotte acts like a $10 million or $12 million Series A round in New York or the Valley or London. And I think capital is going to understand that value. I think founders have already understood, to Aubrey's point, the quality of life in Charlotte. It's the second fastest growing city, 17th largest city in the U.S., cost of living that's still under the national average. It's just a really fantastic place to plant roots. And when the people do come here, they discover that pretty quickly.
Well, so those are good tailwinds.
Yeah, and
go ahead.
I was just going to make one other comment, JP. I think the other view is the financial services institutions that are in Charlotte actually have embraced this. And I think that's the other piece that's really the market differentiator for Charlotte is. It's not like each one of these financial services companies want to keep everything to themselves. It's actually how you grow the community. And I think that's the other key differentiation that we're offering.
Well, clearly, Charlotte is a major American financial center. You've got a Wells Fargo and Bank of America with massive legacy infrastructure there today. American Banker named their digital banker of the year, and it was Bank of America's head of digital banking, Michelle Moore, who's based there in Charlotte. And I know B of A had some pretty impressive growth numbers in their digital banking that they announced in their annual report this year for the first time. And I know both of you work with B of A and with Wells Fargo. I mean, what does their presence mean to the Charlotte community overall and particularly to the fintech community?
Well, I think in terms of what it meant, especially early on, Bank of America being headquartered here, they had to be on board to start pushing on this. And Bank of America certainly does stuff still all around the country and around the world. They do tech conferences that happen in the Valley, and they're doing stuff in New York, and none of that's going to stop. But we had the conversation with them to do that and participate here in the local community. And they've been just a fantastic supporter and sponsor, from Kathy Bessant to Andrea, the chief operating officer, who's chair also of the Charlotte Chamber, and what Michelle has done. We just heard her speak last week about the digital future for Bank of America and what she has planned. And then Wells Fargo, even you know, while Kobe was here and became part of Wells Fargo, there's more Wells Fargo people here now than there were when it was Wachovia. That sense of critical mass is really important. Their commitment to the community second is really important. And also the fact that they are just as much world-class subject matter experts in these areas as the people that are sitting in London, New York, Singapore, and others. They just happen to be a heck of a lot more accessible when they're here in Charlotte. And I think that's been, it has really been everything, because we looked at where we had DNA, that the storyline would be true versus trying to make something up, which we couldn't do in Charlotte, like in biohealth or something like that. Fintech mm-hmm. was just the natural answer to move us forward.
Well, and I got a chance to see that firsthand. Aubrey invited me to join him on an internal a video cast done at Bank of America a few months ago, and we really talked a lot about what fintech is and what it means to consumers, how it's growing in influence, and what it means for the bank and for the industry. You know, Aubrey, what how do you see that evolving with the large banks and the other banks that you work with in your role across the country and around the world?
Well, so I think what is what was interesting, I think, about that session that JP, that you and I had, it was interesting, I think, as a part of what Bank of America's commitment in Charlotte for fintech actually kind of allowed them to say, you know what, we need to start to drive broader awareness inside of the company. So that was kind of the opportunity for you and I to actually come in there and talk about really what does fintech mean, how does it become bigger, how does it get off of kind of some of the bleeding edge so that the whole organization starts to understand and appreciate how you can start to harness this. And I think what I see kind of as I go talk to banks around the globe is I think the really market-leading ones are the ones that are actually saying, hey, how do I actually expand my knowledge of what fintech is? How do I actually use it as a agent to actually go back and help change the bank? Because I think that's what a lot of these leaders are looking at seeing is saying, I need to use this outside thinking, this nimble, agile thinking, looking at problems differently to help me actually grow and change. And I think those are the banks that we see around the globe that are really starting to kind of lead in actually how they change that. And I don't think that necessarily has to be, you know, Bank of America in Charlotte, North Carolina. That can be, you know, a bank in Malaysia, for example, is a place that I was at last year with Maybank. They're really trying to look at saying, actually, how can they actually go back and use some of those things to change it? So I think there's really a lot of banks in a lot of different parts of the world that are actually really looking at this and saying, how do I use this as my change?
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. I want to make sure to save a little bit of time for our Chief Snarketing Officer, Ron Shevlin, to give his moment of snark. But Aubrey Hawes and Dan Roselli from Oracle and Queen City FinTech, respectively, thanks so much for joining us and talking about Charlotte. Again, on June 21st, we have Next Money Southeast coming up in Charlotte. I'll be there hosting the day. Dan and Aubrey will both be there, and it's going to be an awesome event again this year. So, guys, thanks for joining us, and we'll get some of your colleagues from Bank of America and Wells Fargo on with us, too.
Great. Thanks so much, JP.
All right, thanks. Hey, Ron, over to you. You had a lot to say this week. Go for it.
Have you ever been ranked as a fintech influencer on any of the lists that have been published? If so, then congratulations. You must be so proud. I know I was. I showed my daughter one list where I was ranked. She looked at it for a few seconds, made a face, and said, "Nice. Too bad you're not influential around here." Over the past few months, hundreds of people have shown up on the burgeoning list of fintech influencer rankings. These lists have jumped the shark, and I'm going to call them out for what they are. Shameless attempts to drive traffic to their site by publishing nonsense rankings based on voodoo quantitative approaches. Now, there are many reasons why these lists are nonsense, but the most basic and important reason is this. You can't easily measure influence. Influence comes down to having an impact on one or both of two things, what someone thinks and what someone does. And both of those things are difficult, if not nearly impossible, to measure. Very few people in fintech meet the first criteria. Brett King and Chris Skinner easily qualify as they have shaped what people believe about fintech and digital banking, yet neither of them were included on two recent influencer lists. Why? Because some particular social media score of theirs wasn't high enough, as if a social media score could measure the impact and influence of their published thoughts and ideas. The over-reliance on social media scores, and the clout score in particular, is a big contributor to this nonsense. According to its website, the clout score takes into account the ratio of reactions you generate compared to the amount of content you share. The stupidity of this cannot be overstated. What clout is saying is that if you tweet the link to someone else's content, your tweet is considered content itself. That's nonsense. One list touts that it updates its rankings every 2 weeks. More nonsense. Influence doesn't vary that much week by week. Frequency isn't important. It's the quality of content that matters, but nowhere does that get captured in any of these rankings. You know, if all of this were just a matter of ego stroking a group of insecure, overly sensitive fintech types, this wouldn't even be worth listening to. But there are real-world consequences to these bogus rankings. I heard that one influencer tried to use his ranking to justify getting equity from a fintech startup. Fortunately, the startup asked him, "But what value do you provide?" I'm sure there'll be people who'll hear this and think that I'm just sore that I haven't been included on this or that influencer list. And they would be right. After all, if all those other big shots are so influential, why aren't they doing the moment of snark on Breaking Banks?
Oh, Ron, I wish I had time to comment on that, but I don't. I want to thank all of our guests. Don't forget to visit us at breakingbanks.com and download us on Google Play, SoundCloud, and Apple Podcasts. So that's it, and stay tuned next week for more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.